Hello, and welcome to Millennial 2017, number 64, and this is with James Alsop. James, welcome to the channel.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
I think most people will be well aware of you, but just for the sake of it, why don't you introduce yourself to people?
Well, sure. If they were well aware of me on Twitter, then they are now well aware of the fact that I've been unceremoniously showed by the Twitter overlords. So thank you to Jack Dorsey for that. I am a guy who I've been making YouTube content now for about a year. I've had my channel running for about a year, have approximately 180,000 followers here on YouTube. I had about 25,000 on Twitter, and I'm still active on Facebook and Gab, of course. But I do videos and live streams and all of that kind of stuff. I'm also going to start writing here pretty soon now that I have so much more free time. So thank you actually to Twitter for banning me, because now I have free time to write. But I got into politics from the kind of normie conservative sphere. Growing up, I was a big fan of people like Glenn Beck or Dinesh D'Souza. But as I've grown up and gone through college here, my views have matured and progressed. And now I'm here soundly in the identitarian camp. So left libertarianism behind, and I think I've made the right decision.
Yeah, people rarely look back, to be honest. It's funny, people are so passionate about libertarianism while they are libertarians. But then once they've progressed to identitarianism, they never seem to miss. It rarely seems to happen that they go, oh, I wish I could still desire, constant liberty and all that. They're quite, I think it's a funny thing. It's sort of, they don't have any doubts. It's strange, mm-hmm. because as I say, when they are libertarians, they tend to be fervent libertarians. You don't really get a middle of like a milquetoast libertarian.
Right. Well, libertarianism, the one thing that I do appreciate about it, and that I think some people do tend to miss when they have come over from it, is the very clear set of rules and the very clear ideology, right? Your ideology is three letters, the NAP. Okay. And so if something doesn't violate the non-aggression principle, then under libertarian philosophy, widely accepted libertarian philosophy, it's going to be okay. And so that provides you a very easy and consistent framework for looking at the world. You can look at things and say, okay, well, is someone's rights being infringed? No? All right, then it's acceptable. And that is easy and comforting for many people because it gives them an easy lens to look through. But of course, the non-aggression principle does get into some thorny aspects, right? When you're looking at things like, children consenting, or you're looking at things like opioids and drugs, there can be a consensual element to, for example, like a child prostitution that could be consensual in a libertarian framework, but it's something that we as a society view as disgusting and immoral and wrong and worthy of drawing and quartering in most places. So you kind of run into some issues there that the NAP doesn't have an answer for, that libertarianism doesn't have an answer for. And in the increasingly globalized world we're living in, libertarianism is effectively surrender. Right, to be a libertarian in modern America, in why America, that is effectively surrendering the country to the hordes of third world immigrants that want to vote your freedoms away. Because if you're a libertarian, you don't believe, most libertarians, many libertarians do not believe that the state should be exercising power to prevent people from coming across the border. They believe in freedom of motion, freedom of freedom to live wherever you want. And that sounds nice on paper, but what that results in is the ideological enabling of massive amounts of third world migrants to come into your country and vote your liberties away. And this is the other thing that libertarianism doesn't address, is demographics and race. Because when you are a libertarian, you have to believe that, at least from the state's perspective, all should be equal, right? You have to believe that the state should treat all individuals equally. But we know that all individuals are not equal. We know that all groups have different characteristics and traits that make them unique, and they all have different interests. And so for the libertarian, I'm steamrolling you here, but libertarian,
it's very fun. It's okay. Don't worry.
For the libertarian, they won't consider these things. The libertarian will think that, well, as long as these Mexicans or Sri Lankans or whoever want to come in and they want to play by the rules of the capitalist system, they're fine. But what they don't realize and they don't really care about is that in America, as we have it now, as it stands now, everyone has an equal right to vote, and these people vote 70-30, 80-20 for the left. They vote for less liberty, they vote for less freedom. And so the libertarian is then in a paradox where they can't want free motion of people and free motion of people to live in the United States, because then that will necessarily result in the destruction of those liberties they so cherish. So those are some of the holes in the libertarian framework and holes in the libertarian mindset that I'm glad to have moved away from, and I'm glad to now have an answer for. Because as a identitarian or someone on the alt-right, you can just say, well, you know, it may be aggressive for the state to prohibit people from coming into the country. It may be an act of aggression to deport people, but I don't care. We have a country and a nation to protect, and that's what matters more than these abstract moral concepts.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's hilarious when you get to this thing about, like, what if the child consents, though? Did you see that meme?
Oh, yeah. And there's the meme about, you know, you'll look in these libertarian Facebook groups, and people will have serious debates about whether or not it would be moral to run a child prostitution ring out of your house because, you know, no rights are being infringed on.
Oh, God.
For the nihilistic libertarian, it's like, well, you can find a way to justify that with the libertarian framework, right? But if you have a sense of morals that is a little bit, you know, less mentally ill, then you can clearly look at that on its face and realize that is a priori messed up.
Yeah, and it's just based on selfishness. I mean, it's just awful, really, inhuman. I guess that's a nice takedown of libertarianism. It's very enjoyable. I have done several videos against just moaning about libertarianism on the channel. And, you know, you do get some people who resent it. And I understand why, because they do have a lot of faith in it. And it's sort of like, God damn, I wish I didn't have to give up on this dream. Mm-hmm. I understand that. But it's like a lot of things. Eventually, principles have to give way to reality.
Right.
Again, this comes up with the skeptics as well. You know, okay, you might believe in individualism, but how are you going to protect the individual from collectives who want to fuck them up?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or collectives that just don't believe in individualism. They reject our Western framework entirely, and it's just not even a concept to them. No, absolutely. And that's so true. And these people, you will call them on this, and they will try to hold you to their moral standard, right? I saw this thing with Destiny going around, where apparently Destiny debated someone, and they called him on this, and they mentioned something to this effect, and the response is, well, I just don't believe in that framework. I just don't believe in the collective framework. It's like, well, you don't have to, right? But the problem is your enemies do. The problem is that your enemies definitely do believe in collectivism. The groups that want to destroy you, they are a collective. And so if you disarm yourself against collectives, then you will be crushed, right? If we try to fight against collectivism as a group of scattered individuals, it'll just never work out, because the collective will always be stronger. And the other thing I'd like to say about libertarianism too is that it's not inherently a bad philosophy, right? There are a lot of elements to libertarianism that, in my ideal state, I would like to see implemented. Things like ideally a small government, ideally low taxes, ideally the freedom to do effectively what you wanted, as long as you're not harming people or you're not causing, you know, undue negative social externalities. I think those are all good principles. I like to be left alone. I live out here in the West, and I like the ability to go and just, you know, feel like you're in control of your life and have these big open spaces and all this stuff. It's a nice kind of pioneer LARPing, I guess. But I like that element of being an American. And I know for a lot of Europeans, that won't resonate as much, because it's just not a part of most European cultures. But for Americans, the idea of freedom and liberty, these are important concepts. So I would like to see a government that respects that, a government that is not invasive, that doesn't, you know, take chip away at our privacy rights. Those are some of the elements of libertarianism that I do like. But the fact is, you can only have those things in a country that is built up of a population that is conducive to those values, right? You're not going to have a libertarian paradise in Somalia or in in Sri Lanka or in Indonesia. It's just not going to happen. The people there just don't support that. The people, frankly, the IQ levels of the people there don't support those things. So for these concepts, and the other part of that is that libertarianism, a libertarian social order, requires social trust, requires social capital. There are not going to be as many police or law enforcement agencies out there to keep the peace, and you're relying on the goodwill of the people and the good nature of the people to get along with each other and to engage in pro-social behavior. And so, frankly, when you have a multiracial country, when you have a racially fragmented country, and we can look at the sociological research, you'll never have a productive libertarian society. You'll never have individuals getting along with each other and respecting each other's rights. You can't have that in a multiracial society. It's just not how tribes work, not how people work, not our human nature. So even if you are a libertarian who wants to have these things, wants to have this kind of society, you need white people. You need Western people. You need good demographics. You need America's original demographics before you can even have this conversation.
Yeah. It's definitely something that comes into play. And I think we're increasingly seeing it. I mean, it's actually playing out in front of us that as our countries become multiracial, problems are just piling upon problems in terms of conflict between the different groups, the different races. And there's always this low-level animosity, this low-level suspicion between the groups. I know that there will be liberals who genuinely have a life in which they're just getting along with other liberals who are of different races. But I think that's very much a select group. And I think it relies on the environment that they're in. My mind always drifts back to UC Davis, that sort of utopia. And it relies on the economics being pretty luxurious. I think poor areas, oh, fuck. You know, one of the cruelest things that I think has happened as a result of mass immigration is the destruction of working class communities. And I think that probably is the case in America as well. It's definitely the case in Britain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
I wish I'd said that to Mike Isaacs, to be honest, because one of the things he said was that your views lead to genocide. And I wish I'd said, okay, London used to have many different working class communities. They no longer exist. So it's not genocide, but it is destruction of communities. Those are now just atomized. They're just flung to the four corners of the country. They don't exist now. And you know, if that keeps happening, then the people, the genes won't exist anymore.
Right. I mean, when you make it so that people who are, like, for example, the typical American factory worker, right, they're probably, if they're a typical white middle-class American factory worker, they're in between IQ, 90 and 110, right? And that's smart enough to be able to do some of the complex work that takes place in factories and fix machines and do the machine work that is required in these factories. And those are great skills that, right now, most of those skills I wouldn't have, right? I don't know how to do those things. So you need to be of some level of intelligence to be able to do these middle-class jobs. Or, for example, if you're like a contractor or a plumber or something, those are very important jobs. You're not like intellectual, but that's fine. You're hardworking and you're smart and you do your job just well. But as we globalize and as we increase the amount of people in this country as two things take place, right? As mass migration takes place and you replace the population, and as automation takes place, and as machines can do more and more of that work, then you result in a class of people, right, that is smart enough to work. Right there, and they have too much work ethic and too much honesty and integrity to just live on welfare. So these people are smart enough to work, smart enough to do these jobs, but the jobs that are now available for them have either been automized and they're being done by machines, or they're being done for lower wages by less intelligent people who can figure out how to press the buttons the right way and are coming in from these foreign countries. And so we're really, really replacing. It's like a pincher, right? On two fronts, we are just squeezing out the American middle class and the American white middle class because there are no jobs for them anymore. The amount of jobs they can have is rapidly shrinking. And the jobs they can still have and can still find are being done for pennies on the dollar by cheap foreign labor. It's really a bad deal for them. But we have these overlords in the GOP and in the Republican Party coming out and telling us, oh, it's great because the middle class. I found a book a couple of days ago by this guy named Michael Medved, who is a Jewish talk radio host from Seattle. And he wrote a book about how the middle class is doing just fine because look at the standard of living and look at how many more TVs and microwaves the middle class can buy now than they could before. The middle class is doing just great. It's like, well, yeah, you can buy more stuff because the cost of goods has decreased due to international manufacturing and bulk shipping and things like that. But if you can't find a job, then why does it even matter, right? If you can't find a place to work and you can't send your kids to school.
You're fucked over your own working class. That's the crux of it, I think, because then that's going to have terrible social consequences. You're going to have a permanent underclass. I mean, the only thing they'll have to do is collect welfare and reproduce. It's just horrendous.
Right. You're turning them into human animals. Right, this type of hand-to-mouth, welfare-dependent human animal that cannot work, cannot do anything for themselves, cannot build a society, cannot maintain a society, and frankly, I think this is one of my problems with socialism. Generally, is that when you allow people to just live without, and this is not all socialist economies, of course, but when you allow people to just live without any effort, they will stop seeking to better themselves. Right, they'll stop seeking.
Yeah, they'll languish.
Right,
they'll just languish and rot.
Yeah, and we've seen that certainly with communities in America that are more welfare dependent than others. And I don't want the white working class to become another one of these communities that just lives day to day and on government food stamps and can't work. And the thing is, these people have good work ethic. They want to work. They want to be productive members of society. But it's just being made so that they can't because of the economic conditions around them.
Yeah.
And their natural limitations, the IQ limitations and things like that.
Yeah. Now, what would you, just for the sake of it, speculation, what would you do if you were the president to alleviate this situation?
Well, I think the first thing we need to do is stem the tide of immigration coming into the country. We have enough people in America to work right now. We have labor force participation rate is actually very low. I know the unemployment numbers look very low in America, but that's because the people participating in the labor force is down. We have people who have just given up on finding a job. They just can't find a job that pays them well enough to sustain their family. And we're reaching a point where it makes more sense for them to not work because they will lose certain benefits and things like that. So what we need to do first is we need to stop immigration because we have a problem. We can't allow more people in. We can't allow more people in that will just depress the wages. Secondly, we need to begin tariffing foreign manufacturing. We need to look at the manufacturing and the manufactured goods that are coming into this country from across the world that are being made. The employees in China are being paid pennies on the dollar what American employees are. They're living 10 to a room in these little, 10 by 10 rooms, and they're all being forced in there and living in essentially slave-like conditions. And Americans have higher standards of living than that. Americans expect to live better than a Chinese sweatshop worker. We'll never be able to compete with Chinese wages. We just won't. We'll never be able to compete with Chinese wages. So we need to stop allowing these companies to dump their goods in our country at record low rates, at record low prices, which then in turn incentivizes manufacturers to go overseas and take American jobs with them. That's the second thing. Third, we need to stop the H-1B visa program. This is the program that allows what they call high-skill immigrants to come over and work on what they say is a temporary basis. It never ends up being temporary, right? They all have a kid over here and they all end up staying here permanently. Most of them do. And we need to stop this. This is the side of immigration that is not always talked about, right? When Republicans talk about immigration, they'll often talk about how great it is that companies can find more cheap labor and drive costs down. Of course, they'll talk about that side, but they don't talk about the effect it's having on the American white collar class and on white collar work. Because for the H-1B visa, this is again visa usually for tech workers to come over. The minimum salary for that is $60,000. Okay, the company has to pay the employee $60,000 for them to get this visa. Now, the average salary for the American computer science graduate is more in the $90,000 range for American college graduates. Well, you see the problem there already, right? Where these foreign workers can come over, work for $60,000, and the American workers want to work for $90,000 on average. So who is the company going to hire if they want to save a buck? are they going to hire Pajit over Marcus every single time? And this is the problem. So we need to either boost this minimum pay up to like $150,000 so only genuine geniuses come over. This is what the program was designed to do. It was designed to bring genius engineers over, okay? And not just your regular code monkey types. But of course, because the companies are effectively writing this policy, it's brought over a lot of the more low-level coding work. So we need to either raise that minimum threshold for foreign workers up to $150,000 or more, or just cut it entirely. Cut the program. Let Americans do these jobs. And if we do these three things, where we stop all immigration, we tariff foreign manufacturing, and we cut down or eliminate guest worker programs, you're going to see companies forced to hire American, or you're going to see companies forced to raise wages. In fact, you're going to see both, because companies will no longer be able to pay Paco cents on the dollar of what they're going to have to pay an American to do the work. So while this may result in higher prices, it will also result in, I believe, a more healthy economy and a skyrocketing labor force participation rate. People will come back into the economy that have left the economy. And this philosophy, these three steps, can be repeated in the UK. This is the cool thing about economics, is that the principles tend to be universal. And you can apply these principles to the people, to Scotland or to Ireland or to Britain, because there are people in those countries, and I know, that are hurting just as much as the American middle classes. One of the stories about Brexit was the fishing, the fishermen in Scotland and Wales, I guess it was, were decimated by EU trade regulations, and the EU just allowing foreign fisheries to dump their goods into the Great Britain, to the UK, at low rates that the Scottish and Welsh fishermen cannot compete with. So,
yeah, I mean, this is the thing about globalization. It does lead to lower costs, but it fucks over those who need to charge more if they're to have a standard of living.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. And the thing is, you can look at a lot of these immigrants that come over and look at the way they live. And, you know, I applaud them for sacrificing a way of life in order to save more money for their family. And this is one of the things that I think Americans should actually learn from immigrants on. The immigrant populations, they tend to be the ones that are working and have jobs. They tend to be pretty good with savings, right? They tend to be pretty good with putting money aside. And that's something that Americans, I think we're oftentimes a little bit too frivolous with our money. But what they do is they will sacrifice cost of living massively in order to save more money. And so you look at how a lot of these immigrant populations live, and they live, you know, four families to a house. This is one of the problems that we have in the real estate market out here, is people will try to buy a house and then try to get it zoned as a four family dwelling. And, you know, in America, we don't do that, right? In America, that's just not how we live. And so our zoning laws don't allow for that to happen, because we don't want to have, you know, four families in a property that's eight cars or at least, and it just creates a mess for the neighborhood. We just don't do that in America. But in these other countries, they do. In these other countries, their idea of zoning for a house is fitting as many people into it as you can, and you know, packing it to the brim like a sardine can. And so these people will live with, again, four or five families to a four bedroom house. Cost of quality of life is obviously lower if you're doing that, but these people will then they'll be able to work for less, right? Because they don't need a house for themselves. The family doesn't need a house for itself. These people will work for less than Americans.
Yeah, it's exactly the same in Britain, and with the Polish plumbers, that's the cliche. That they will live eight guys in a flat or whatever, and yeah, so they don't have the same requirements. So of course they can charge less, and also they're less scared of the law. And I guess that's because you're already in a foreign country, so you're less in sync with the legal situation, the cultural situation in that new country. So it's kind of easier to, I'm guessing, just psychologically, sure, that there, because there is definitely a problem with them doing work without certificates. So again, they outcompete the native worker. Mm-hmm. This is happening in all sorts of different ways. It's just madness.
Yeah, the idea of licensing, for example, it's like if you're coming from a place that doesn't have running water, you know, what the fuck is a license? You know, I'm just going to go out and do the work. In America, you know, we have a little bit different standards. We want to have insurance. If you're a contractor, we want you to have a bond so that in case you do the work wrong, the property manager or owner can come back and go after your bond and collect money. We have a whole system in place in America for good reason. Okay. And these things are in place for good reason. And I know this is very antithetical to what I was saying about libertarianism earlier.
Yeah,
this isn't exactly the free market, but we have, this is an example where regulations are a good thing, right? Because you don't want just any Joe Blow being able to run around and say, oh yeah, I'll fix your pipes. And he can come in and, you know, destroy your whole house and then just walk away without any liability. Like, it's good that we have some regulation in place to prevent that. Now, if you're from a foreign country that doesn't have that same culture, then you'll be mystified by that requirement. You won't know, and you won't value it. Fundamentally, you will not value it as much as a native person would. And so you're less likely to abide by it, right? Because you're like, fuck this. I don't need this, you know? And so you're just not going to do it. And
exactly. You're not plugged into the culture as a whole. It's not yours. Therefore, right, you're going to be less concerned with it being abused.
Right. Why would you have any reason to respect it? It's not your culture, not your country, not your people. Why would you have any reason for them to be respected? Now, as Westerners, we can kind of get intellectual here and say, well, you know, all cultures deserve respect and all people deserve respect in their own countries, in their own places. And so, you know, when I go to a foreign country, I'm going to respect their culture and respect their customs. And I was in Japan last summer, for example, and I know people will call me a weeb in the chat, and I'm okay with that. When I was over there, I was very, very careful to be quiet, you know, to not run places, you know, there's one example where I was in a train station in the little hamlet of, I think, Fukuchiyama, I think it's called. And I was using an outlet to charge my cell phone. And, you know, in America, you know, if there's a power outlet, you know, whatever, on the ground in a train station, you can go ahead and use it. Well, in Japan, it turns out those power outlets are only for company use, only for the use of the rail line. So these two guys who didn't really speak English came over to me, two employees, and they were pointing at the outlet. And, I was mortified that I was doing something wrong because, you know, here I am, a guest in their foreign country.
You'd be self-conscious.
Yeah. I'm a guest in their country and I'm looking like a low class, you know, just scum who's breaking this social norm that everyone else around me understands, but I don't. So I you know, quickly undo it and, you know, excuse me. So sorry. And they're okay. You know, they smile and whatever. And it's all fine, but from then on, I was more conscious of social norms because I didn't want to look like an outlier, to look like someone who was taking advantage of their hospitality. Now, at the same time, when I was in Japan, that same trip, I was at a restaurant and there was a Chinese family in there, two Chinese women and their children, and they were just screaming and carrying on and yelling and had no respect for the people around them, no respect for cultural norms, because that is totally out of the norm in Japan. And you could see the looks on the faces of the Japanese people around them. They were again mortified by what's going on. But these Chinese, they just didn't have the respect, didn't care. Fundamentally, they just didn't care that they were abusing someone else's hospitality and violating their social norms.
I've heard terrible things about Chinese tourists. So apparently, wherever they go, they behave badly. So
yeah,
I don't know why.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and you know, Chinese tour, then yeah, it's a recurring theme throughout Asia that people will tell you that they just don't like the Chinese tourists because they are rude and loud and obnoxious. And I know that Americans often think that we have that stereotype about us, and I guess in some places we might, but throughout Asia, you talk to people who are from there, the stereotypes of Americans are much more positive than they are of Chinese tourists. People tend to think of all Asians as like a monolith, but nothing could be further from the truth. If you know much about Asian culture, you'll know that these people don't often get along very well. So the point being that as an American, as someone who's conscious of these different cultures and expectations, I was disappointed in myself, I guess you could say, for violating their social norms. But a lot of people from across the world don't have that same internal regulator. A lot of people, and culturally, it just isn't instilled in them. In America, we are instilled a respect for other cultures. Now, it's kind of funny because we're instilled this respect, but then we also have all these people who come over here and absolutely fucking hate us and our culture. So it's kind of
weird. It's the dichotomy. It's not because you're American, it's because you're white.
Yeah.
The same thing happens here. I mean, it infuriates me that Muslim women will wear the burqa And I think, who the fuck do you think you are to come here and violate our social norms so flagrantly, so visibly, mm-hmm. And shamelessly? You know, and I know you can say, well, it's cultural or it's religious or whatever, but it doesn't matter. It's still completely alien to us. And they, for what it's worth, I used to think, and this is a sort of side issue, I used to think that we should ban the burqa, but I now don't think that, because I think it would just create even more antagonism, and it wouldn't actually get the desired result, which is, we want them to leave. So, I don't know, maybe banning it would tempt them to leave. I'm not sure. But I think on its own, it wouldn't be enough. It would.
Right. Whether it's cultural or religious, it doesn't matter, because Islam is not our culture and it's not our religion. So you got to go back on two fronts there. Like, it doesn't even matter.
Exactly. It's not our problem whether it's cultural or religious. I don't care.
I don't care. It's alien and it needs to go back. The other thing is, too, in America and throughout the West, think about how conscious we are of respecting people of other nationalities. One of them, I don't know, was this going on in Europe too? Where white people are being told that we can't ask where people are from, right? We can't go to someone who's born and say, hey, where are you from?
Because that kind of thing. It's just another way to chip away at white confidence.
Right. Right. We can't ask someone who's Asian, you know, hey, where are you from? Like, look, I'm someone, and again, call me a weeb all day, but I like Asian cultures, specifically Northeast Asian cultures and Eastern Asian cultures. And I think they're interesting. And I've taken a lot of classes here in university on their history and culture and religion. Like, that's something that interests me. And so if I want to start a conversation with someone about, hey, like, do you want to, I'd like to know more about where you're from. That's a totally normal thing that people should be able to do with each other. It's a totally normal thing that in 1700s, 1800s.
It's completely natural. It's right. Absolutely the natural thing to do. And, it's interesting because the leftist social policy often boils down to preventing people from doing the natural thing, preventing them from reacting in the natural way to something and sort of instilling artificial ideas, artificial behaviors. And obviously civilization does require this. It does require to some degree that we don't react in instinctual ways. And I know that civilization is an artificial veneer, but that's kind of by the by. Fundamentally, when something is foreign, we should be allowed to see it as foreign and exotic and interesting and novel, right, and ask about it. That's just, it's so natural to do that. And to not do it is kind of perverse.
And think about the dichotomy we have now, where if you're white in America or in Europe, you can't ask where a foreign person is from. You can't ask about their culture. You can't ask about their history. You can't ask about what brought them to your country. You can't ask any of that. But if you're a foreigner, a non-white foreigner in a white country, you can say, fuck the people of this country, fuck these people, fuck this nation, I hate this place, we're tearing this down, and we're rebuilding it in our image. Think about what you can get away with socially, whites versus non-whites. The amount that non-whites can get away with in white countries is absolutely staggering, especially when you compare it to what whites have been browbeaten into accepting, our new place socially, where we are truly, in many more ways than one, second-class citizens in our own country.
Well, I mean, we're even accommodating Muslim polygamous marriage, a guy having multiple wives in the welfare system. I don't know if that's been stopped, but I remember reading a few years ago that they were going to start paying welfare payments to Muslim men based on how many wives they had. That's remarkable.
This is the thing that I've heard they do this in the UK. Maybe you can confirm this. But what they'll do is, because Muslim men tend to have more than one wife, what they'll do is they'll have multiple wives and they will put them each up in a home, right? Each wife has four children, right? And so the state, the councils look at this as, oh, here's a single woman with four children. We need to give her X amount of benefits, right? Thousands of pounds a month or whatever. But these men have like six wives, and they're doing this scam in six different councils, in six different cities. And so what they'll do is they'll have all these different women who are living subsidized by the government, and then the men are skimming 10% off the top for their own livelihood, in addition to working at, you know, falafel stand or something. And so these people are being paid, their existence is being paid for almost entirely on state funds. And it's happening six times over, six women per man.
It's so farcical you couldn't make it up, you know. But this kind of stuff does go on in Britain for sure, and I'm sure it goes on in other European countries as well. I mean, there was that thing in Sweden about allowing child brides. You know, it's so ridiculous. At first, when I read that, I thought this has to be some, you know, scare story. It has to be like exaggeration. Right. But no, I think from what I could gather, it's real. The Swedish government are now going to, they're not going to stop Muslim men from marrying little girls.
Yeah, you know, it's
I mean, there is a sense of surrender. It's appalling. And I do think that, see, this is another example of how the current establishment is just completely weak. You know, to give into something like that, it shows that, you know, really you just want to be replaced. You just want your power to be taken away from you. You're tired, you're weary, and you're giving up. And this is why I think we definitely need to just replace the political culture in so many European countries, because as it is, they're not going to see the light and change. They can't. They're all implicated. They've all gone along with this, and it's too embarrassing to even admit to. Yeah. So they're not going to change.
Yeah, no, for the, I think of it in American terms, but it's certainly true in European terms as well. You think about the conservatives, right? The conservative parties in Europe, or the Republican Party in the United States. These parties have had power. Many of them have had power while these things are happening, right? While this mass migration is taking place, while the great demographic replacement is taking place. In America, we often forget, but Ronald Reagan, this guy who's held up as a conservative scion, was the one who gave amnesty to millions of illegals, 3 million illegals, given amnesty by Reagan back in the 80s. And George Bush was another guy who was pushing for open borders, another Republican in name only, of course. And then in Germany, Merkel and the CDU have been overseeing the mass migration. So like every European country at some stage or the other, I think, has had a right of center government. Maybe not Sweden, maybe not Sweden, but most of the other countries have had a right of center government. You know, Sarkozy in France, Blair in the UK. Like, yeah, they all have had conservative governments that were overseeing these cultural and demographic transplants taking place. And so they can't admit that they failed. They can't admit that diversity was a lie. They can't admit that integration is a myth, because it totally blows up their narrative over the past 50 years. And so what you're going to be forced to see is a forcible realignment of the political system, where parties like what is the one in Austria? The FPÖ is going to be replacing the ÖVP, right? They're going to be coming to power in the next couple of years. In Germany, the CDU-CSU coalition will collapse, and if they can get their act together, AfD will start to rise. In the UK, you guys are just fucked. So I don't know what to tell you, because there are no good political options right now in the UK.
No, none. It's a fucking disaster.
Right. In America,
UKIP are just civic cucks. So yeah. Sorry, go on.
Well, UKIP, they were going down the right road for a while with Farage at the helm. And I can't get too much into it, but based on private meetings that people who I know directly have had with Farage, like, he knows everything, and you know, take that for to mean what you want, but he knows everything that's going on. He's just kind of found himself on the outside of British political life now. I do think his resignation post Brexit was a massive mistake, and probably one of the greatest mistakes politically of this decade in any country.
I suspect he was just utterly exhausted at the time.
That's probably true. That's probably true, but now it's making re-entry so much harder for him to get back into politics, and he's just like bouncing around on different radio shows now. Like, things would certainly be better if he had stayed in, I believe. And then in America, you'll start to see a forcible realignment too. You'll start to see people like Paul Neelan, who is running for Congress. I hope and I am optimistic that people like that, people who are aware of demographics, who are aware of America's history as a white country, who are aware that America was founded by whites, who are aware of the 1790 Immigration and Naturalization Act that limited citizenship to free white men of good character, that really, you know, it comes down to, do you want to push back on the anti-white hatred being brought here by our coastal, rootless, transnational, international, globalist, financier, and media elites that are present in this country? Do you want to push back on the anti-white sentiment being brought here by their media, by their chosen immigrants, or do you not? That's what it's going to come down to. And I think we're going to start to see a great number of new candidates politically, and political movements, and a new political ethos, and a new political culture, really, that realigns that this is the new American right wing. Identitarianism, nationalism, and resistance to multiculturalism, and pride in our heritage and history. This is the new American right wing.
Right. So you're optimistic. I mean, I think that the same thing will happen in Europe as well, but I think it's going to take longer for various reasons. But I do think it's coming. I think that people can put up with decay and degeneration and despair only for so long, until it starts to really hurt. You know, at first it's kind of fascinating and novel, and then it's just de rigueur. But then eventually it starts to become nightmarish. And I think that we're heading towards that. And unfortunately, it's going to have to become that. It's going to have to become really bad before people do wake up. But they will wake up. I am confident of that. I think that, you know, as I've said before, the ever-increasing numbers of people who are getting into our stuff, this is growing. It's not a fringe thing. It's not static. And it's definitely not dying. It's growing.
On a level playing field, you're absolutely right. On a level playing field, we would be starting to win. But as we see, the entire establishment is genuinely stacked against us. And the fact that we are able to have this broadcast on YouTube right now, I think is, we have to take what we can get. And this is a great thing. And I'm surprised that you haven't been thrown to the wolves for wrong think yet, Woz, because they're certainly coming. And people, if they're given the information, if the information is allowed to flow like it should, people will wake up. People will start to be aware of what's going on. People will start to be aware of this situation in our own countries. Hold on one second here. And they'll start to realize this is not natural. This is not the way things are supposed to be. But that's going to require the information to get out there. That's going to require the information to flow to the people and for people to see what's going on in order to allow them to wake up. And what we're seeing now is that the entire corporate establishment is coming out against us. The corporate establishment that does control these media platforms is coming out against us. And they were shocked, right? Because they control TV, they control the radio, they control the newspapers, and they control the flow of information for so long. And so they were able to suppress any kind of nationalistic or identitarian concerns by simply not allowing it to rise to the mainstream, not allowing it to reach the people. But now with social media, where anyone has access to run a media operation bigger than the New York Times, for example, get more live viewers than CNN, now they're concerned because the genuine information now can reach the people, and the goyim can start to know. And this is what desperately concerns them, because if people realize what's going on and realize why things are going on, they will be livid and they will take to the streets and they will take their countries back. So we need to be in a place where people can receive the information, people can get red-pilled, and then act on that. And I think that's what we're going to move forward to. And we talked about this a little bit before we went online, but I think we're going to have to start preparing for life without Twitter, life without Facebook. And I know we've said that in the past, but maybe the fact that I got banned is now making it more real for me. But, you know, we're going to have to go to the days of the email newsletter. Right, we're going to have to go to the days of going to your website, and not everything will be centralized on Twitter. And to stay in touch, people will have to visit your website, and that sucks. But the further they suppress it, the harder they push the boot down on our neck. I think the more and more people will begin to be curious about what it is we're saying and why it's being suppressed. And so I think that is what's it called? The Streisand effect, right? Where something's in the news and you don't want it talked about, but by forcing people not to talk about it, you lead more people to talk about it, look into it. I think that is going to be on the horizon for us very soon. And while it's not ideal, it's not very convenient, it's something that I think we're going to have to be prepared for, and that as soon as we prepare for it, we'll be better off, because then we'll be ready to live with it when it does happen.
Yes. Okay, well, words of optimism there from James Allsop. I think we should leave it at that. That's a good place to end. So you're basically positive about the future. I mean, you sound full of energy, and that's very it's nice.
We can't not
lots of people, you know. Right. Yeah, it's been a tumultuous year.
We can't afford not to be optimistic. And everything that has gone wrong this year, everything that has happened that has not been in our favor, that has not served to in this meta-political sphere, everything that has gone on that has not gotten us closer to ensuring a future for, I'm not going to say the exact phrase because of the complications, but essentially protecting white people, right? Everything that has not served to get us closer to our goal of protecting us in our own homelands, we've learned from it, okay? And people will say, oh, well, this went wrong and Charlottesville was a disaster and this is so bad and the alt-right is done and Trump is finished. Like, look, you can have that mindset. You can have the mindset that everything's fucked and that we're finished. And if that's really what you think, then you might as well get a vasectomy, because, you know, get a vasectomy, stop worrying about the future, don't have kids. If you really think we're that screwed, then go do that. Then
yeah, but don't flat-pile other people.
Right. But don't sow dissent. Don't tell people it's over. Don't say it's not worth fighting anymore, okay? Because we've learned from everything that's gone wrong, and we're now prepared not to make those mistakes in the future, right? When you're raising a child and your child does something dumb, you know, makes a mistake, they get a bad grade in school or they you know, get in trouble at their school, you don't just like throw your child on the street. We're like, ah, well, fuck you, kid. You know, you messed up. It's all over. You're done. Like, you don't do that. You help the child learn from their mistake so they don't do it again in the future. And that's what we have to do with this movement, is we have to realize that we're going to make mistakes. Things will go wrong. Not everything will be great. In retrospect, Charlottesville had a lot of positives, but it also did have a lot of negatives. And I know people don't want to admit that. But we're going to learn from it. You know, I think the thing we learned from Charlottesville is public rallies at this stage are a bad idea. And if things didn't go wrong at Charlottesville, they would have gone wrong at our next public rally. Okay, they would have gone wrong 6 months from
now. Yeah, it was a lesson that needed to be learned, and it's been learned. So good.
Right, and these drama outbursts between different personalities on the right, you know, people, certainly feelings have been hurt and certainly relationships have been severed and bridges have been burned. But going forward, I think all the personalities involved with these things now know that it doesn't serve anyone's interests to fight like happened about a month ago or 3 weeks ago, whenever all that took place. Like everyone's kind of learned from that and matured from that, I think. And things have improved. And while certain people will never like each other and will never cohabitate the same spaces and we'll never get along with each other all the way, you know, that's fine. That's part of having a big movement. It's not everybody gets along. But we've learned now that we don't have to fight over everything. We don't have to have public disagreements over every little minute disagreement we have. So all of the mistakes that have been made have been learned from. And if you really are black-pilled and think nothing's going to happen, then, you know, unfollow all of us, you know, delete yourself from social media, like just get out of the way, because we're going to try to be optimistic. We're going to try to fight towards protecting our people and our homelands and protecting our national interests and identitarianism. We're going to fight for that. And we're not going to be hampered and held back by the people who just want to black pill and sow dissent and make us question what we're doing. You know, criticism is of course accepted. Criticism that is in good spirit and good faith is certainly accepted, because no one's perfect and we all do need to learn and improve what we're doing. But if you're just going to be someone who's a constant force saying everything is hopeless and you're wasting your time, then this is probably not the right movement for you, not the right community for you.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. We need to be strong and positive and cooperate with each other, not obstruct each other. I do hope that that's been learned, because it didn't do us any good. Who did it benefit? It benefited our fucking enemies. And, you know, they're desperate for us to fail. They're desperate for us to be fighting with each other. They're desperate for us to be finding little flaws with each other. And they love it. So stop playing into their hands. We've got a fucking war to fight here.
Mm-hmm. Think about how much we love it when we see articles about the left tearing itself apart. And we share those and laugh at them and rub salt in the wound. They do the same to us. And we need to stop giving them opportunities to do that.
Exactly. Okay. Well, let's leave it at that. That's a good message to end with. So, James Alsop, thank you very much. People can find your YouTube linked below. If you have any other websites, just let me know and I'll add them as well. Okay. So that was James Alsop in about an hour with Reconquista Germania and then Morgoth. So James Alsop, thank you very much.
Thank you again. Appreciate it.
Okay. And everyone, thanks for listening. See you soon.